So we've arrived at the very beginning of our walk here, with just the 6 miles to start point to go. And from here we can actually see the end, which is quite reassuring with the lighthouse on the end of the head there. Today I'm joined on this 6 mile walk by Phil Bradfield, who's an Open University tutor, and Emily Unell of the Open University's BLAST project. But where we're standing now is on this shingle ridge. Now, is this all natural?
Oh yes, perfectly natural. Yeah, it's been here for about 7,000 to 10,000 years, actually formed after the last ice age. It was caused by the ice. When the ice melted, the sea levels rose, and we've got a similar thing happening today. When it last happened in the ice age, the sea levels rose dramatically and pushed shingle up from the English Channel and formed the shingle ridge, which we've got in front of us now. We've got a broad expanse about 3 miles long, I suppose.
And it's certainly looking quite spectacular. I mean, it's only sort of 9:45 in the morning now, and the sun is shining, and it's just catching it off the sea beautifully there.
It's
very, very nice,
yeah.
And blue.
It's absolutely beautiful. Well, we've parked at the north end of the ridge at a place called Street Gate. Well, there's free parking for 7 or 8 cars, and if you can't get in there, there's a pay and display car park a little way up the hill. This is the point where the road bends inland and goes to the village of Street. And we're at a place called, it used to be called Street Undercliff, because it was a little village, a little fishing village under the cliff at Street.
So we're standing on the beach and we're surrounded with lots and lots of different kinds of pebbles. Why are they all different?
Yeah, there's dozens of different types of rock that have formed these pebbles. And if you look at them closely, they're a bit small here, but when we get further down the ridge and the pebbles are bigger, you can see they're made up of all sorts of things, limestones, sandstones, mudstones, even granite. Mostly they've come from the English Channel, from out in the bay, out in the channel, and they've been swept in. But some of them are carried down by rivers and streams and glacier action in the last ice age period. The natural rock around here, there's quite big, large bits of slate you can see lying around.
Oh yeah.
Those flat grey bits of slate, and that's the natural rock, the bedrock around here. But all the other whites and reds and things are from somewhere else.
Okay.
So, a vast variety of different colours, and very attractive it is.
And is this a unique environment?
It's probably the biggest one like this on this coast. There's one or two more further down. In fact, the walk takes us past a small shingle ridge at Bee Sands that looks very similar, but not as attractive and large as this one. And it's not formed in the same way as some other shingle bars, like Portland, for example, which is quite different. This one was formed by, as I say, by the ice pushing the shingle inland. Whereas the one at Portland's formed in a quite different way. Right, so we're going to walk to our next stopping point, which is about halfway between here, between the first one and the monument, about 500 yards, 500 metres along.
So having started walking along this ridge, the first thing we notice is it's how hard the shingle is to walk on.
Yes, it's much better if you walk at the top where the grass is. It's harder underfoot and better to walk on. Actually, the coast path is the other side of the road up here, I think. I think it goes the other side of the road. It goes backwards and forwards, but you don't get such a good view if you walk the other side of the road.
We've walked along to stop two now, which is, we're standing right next to a bend in the road sign, and very close to the bend in the road. I mean, has the road always been here?
No, the road was built in the 1850s, and in fact, the road is really what consolidated the ridge and holds it all together. And before the 1850s, if you look at old maps, it was the ridge was breached in various places by the sea. And so the lake would have had salt water mixed with it and wouldn't be the habitat it is today. So really, the road, laying down the road, consolidated everything, held it all together. But it doesn't always last, because even today, severe storms can damage it. And in 2001, there was a really bad storm that undermined the road, washed away the foundations of the road, and they had to rebuild it a bit further inland.
You were saying that this road was breached by a storm. Does that mean that with global warming, as the seas rise, it's more and more likely to happen?
I think it must do.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the sea level is definitely rising. And the more it does so, the more likely it is the road's going to get damaged again. There was an idea that they might not rebuild the road at all, they just leave it to nature.
Yeah. Right.
But that's been overruled for the time being.
Where we're standing now, you can actually, I think, see where the road once was and how it's perhaps been moved back.
That's right, yes. Yeah. It was the old road was severely damaged in January in 2001 in a major storm, and the road was undermined and had to be it was right on the edge of the shingle by then, and it had to be moved inland about I suppose about 30-40 metres inland. So it's now taking a sort of detour inland from about where the monument is to Street Gate.
So setting off again now then, and very clearly we can see the War Memorial Obelisk, which is our next stop.
Do we walk on the grass again? It's a bit of a struggle here, is it?
So we've reached point three on our walk now, and we're standing next to this memorial that was presented by the United States Army in recognition of the people who'd left their homes so that the US Army could come and practice here for the D-Day landings.
That's right, yes, in November 43, the people from six villages around here, about a sort of 6 mile radius, were told to move out of their homes so that they could use it to practice for Normandy. And the reason was that this beach shows a remarkable similarity to one of the Normandy beaches, to Utah Beach. In Normandy, the beach had been flooded, behind the beach was flooded by the Germans, and here you've got the lake behind the beach, so it looks just like the landing beach.
So what were they doing here?
Well, it was the American Army carrying out a full-scale invasion exercise with landing craft and tanks and coming out from landing from Line Bay. From about 10 miles out, they brought their landing craft carrying tanks and personnel and guns and things in and attacked the shore. And the shore was defended and it was live ammunition was used.
So was the exercise a success?
No, it was a disaster, actually. There were about 750 American soldiers were killed here.
Right.
And what happened was the landing craft was spotted by German torpedo boats who torpedoed two of them, I think two or three of them, and the poor soldiers were, you know, in the water and most of them drowned. There were all sorts of other problems. They did find out lots of things from it. Lots of valuable lessons were learned. One of which was you don't put your life jacket on upside down. Some of them apparently had fitted their life jacket wrongly and floated face down in the water, which is not a good idea.
And even at the best time of the year, this sea is still pretty cold here, isn't it?
Oh yeah, I mean, no, you wouldn't last in that sea for longer than about an hour or so. You'd be frozen to death after that.
Did it effectively prepare them for the D-Day landings?
I think they learnt a lot from it.
Yeah.
About cooperation and about using the right radio frequency. The boats couldn't communicate with shore and the shore couldn't communicate. You know, there was all sorts of problems that they found out about. It was a good practice. But what's ironic is that the beach they were practicing for, Utah Beach, far fewer people died there than died in the practice here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, literally about a tenth of the numbers died on the actual beach. Compared with here.
And the memorial here is actually to the locals who were moved out rather than the Americans who sort of moved in. I mean, what kind of size of area are we talking about of clearing for this exercise?
It's about 30,000 acres of land was evacuated, and the people were moved all over the country to North Devon and away to families and friends, and a lot of them never came back. A lot returned. They were given no compensation unless they were farmers. So if your house was destroyed by a shell or something, you'd tough, you know.
Yeah.
The farmers were compensated for livestock and loss of earnings and things, but nobody else.
And did they manage to move back in quite soon after D-Day?
I think fairly soon afterwards people started coming back, once they'd cleared the shells and exploded bombs and things, which they still find nowadays. I was talking to a farmer who... when they were digging fence posts, they found a shell, had to be exploded, taken away. And I found bits of shrapnel along this coast and a bullet from a rifle.
So you can find bullets and bits of shrapnel and dog tags. So can we go have a look today, see if we can find them?
Well, we can look while we're walking. It's always good to keep your eyes open. I've only ever found one down here. The best time of year is after the storms, I was told. If you come here in February and it's the weather's been bad, it clears away the shingle and sometimes you get things exposed. But it's worth looking out.
It's a very calm day though, so maybe we won't find anything.
If you look along the tide, along the Strand line, and see what there is there. There's all sorts of flotsam and jetsam. We're going to walk from the monument. We're going to take a slight detour up the road to Slapton Village, just about 100 yards up the road to Slapton Village, and have a look at the lake from the bridge. Right, well, we're at stop four now. We've walked over the road from the war memorial and up the road towards Slapton Village. And just passed over the bridge and we're standing on the observation platform just after the bridge. And we can see most of Slapton Lee, the freshwater lake, separated from the sea by the Shingle Ridge. The whole area is a National Nature Reserve and it's the highest grade of conservation area that there is in the country, and it covers about 180 hectares of land. And I suppose that there's two things about Slapton National Nature Reserve. One is the variety of habitats you get here. There are all sorts of habitats. There's the Shingle Ridge, the lake, there's forests, there's mixed deciduous woodlands, there's the reed beds, streams and so on. So there's all these different habitats. And the other important thing is that you get quite a few rare species here living there, particular birds and plant species that only live in Slapton or nearby.
Yeah, just sitting here, you can hear all of the different kind of birds, can't you? All the different noises. So there must be an awful lot of species.
Are there any sort of particular rare species that are unique to Slapton?
There's a bird called Chetty's warbler, which lives virtually only in the Slapton area. And there's a plant called strapwort, which is apparently very rare, but quite common around the paths around the lake. Those two and others. I mean, it's a habitat for lots and lots of different birds and all sorts of different animals here. If you come down really early in the morning, you can sometimes see otters swimming under the bridge.
You mentioned earlier the sort of thoughts about leaving the road to disintegrate. I mean, if that is breached, what would happen to the freshwater Lee here?
Yeah, it would become a salt marsh. It would be like the water behind Portland, Mill, which is saline, is brackish. And so the freshwater fish wouldn't be able to survive, and a lot of the habitats would change. But the thing is, you can't really fight against nature. In the long term, nature will win. So I don't think the road is the answer. Ultimately, the bridge will go. And we'll be back to what it was 200 years ago.
Right.
We're moving on to stop five now, which is halfway along the Shingle Ridge between the road to Slapton and the village of Torcross. You can see Torcross in the distance, so if you walk along the ridge about halfway.
On our way to point five here, and we've just walked across the car park next to the war memorial, and you're saying that this was a hotel before?
It was a very famous hotel in Victorian times. It was called the Royal Sands Hotel, and you had to be very well off to stay there. And people would come for the fishing in the lake and other delights down here. And it actually got destroyed in the exercises in the D-Day practice.
Right. And then you never thought about rebuilding it?
No, it was completely demolished. What had happened apparently was a little dog stood on a landmine in the hotel. It had been mined, the air, and it stood on it and blew most of it up.
Not good for the dog.
I don't think the dog did well out of it either, no.
Was that a big problem actually, having mines around the area? Afterwards.
I suppose, well, they'd have to clear everything, yeah.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of unexploded shells and bombs and things, but it wasn't too much of a problem. They cleared it quite quickly, I think.
So was it one of those big white hotels? that you got on the front of the sea.
I've only seen photos in... No, it was a big... It doesn't look very, very attractive from the pictures I've seen, but I've only seen views of the back of the hotel.
Right.
So, and of course, there's nothing left of it at all now. The car park is where the hotel was.
Well, as we keep walking up, looking forwards now, we can sort of see, is it three or four sort of sectioned off square areas? What
the fences,
are they for?
Yeah. Well, they're called exclosures, and they're set up by the field centre at Slapton. And really, they're to test the theory that walking damages the vegetation on the ridge. Just like we're doing now.
And does it seem to be doing anything?
Well, if you look at the exclosures, you can see that they're greener inside. So, you know, where people can't walk is obviously plants can grow better. What happens, of course, is that they walk around the edges and it directs them around here. And you end up with no plants around the outside of them. Yeah, it's definitely greener and longer vegetation inside them.
And they do seem to like driving past us quite quickly along this stretch, don't they?
It's the only bit of straight road in the whole of this part of the coast. And what tends to happen is that people get at one end of it and see 3 miles of straight road ahead and just open up and drive down here at 70 miles an hour. So you've got to watch out for the traffic.
Well, having reached stop five here, having a little bit of a break, and looking at the plants that there seem to be more and more of as we sort of walk along here, I mean, how on earth do these plants actually grow in the shingle?
Well, most can't grow actually on the shingle. The only ones that can are specialised plants called pioneers, and we've got a few here. We've got yellow-horned poppy, sea spurge, and there's a kale, I think it is, over there, a cabbage plant anyway of some kind. And those can live actually on the shingle. They're adapted for life on the shingle, and they're very rare that plants can. They've got long, very long roots for getting as much water as possible and holding their position. They've got waxy leaves to stop water loss and store water in the leaves.
So can they cope with the seawater washing over them?
Yeah, that's the waxy leaves, the seawater doesn't damage them. But as you go up, you're getting more and more plants growing on the ridge. What happens is that you get what they call a succession of plants. The pioneers come first. When the pioneers die, they start to produce a soil. The humus from the dead plant starts to break down and produce the soil. And as you go up over the ridge, the soil gets deeper and more plants can grow. And you can see up here, if we come in about 5 metres from the edge of the shingle, you can see you've got more plants growing. There's things like sea campion, some dandelions, sea beet. Notice most of these are sea something or other.
Very, very specific plants,
yeah,
for the
maritime communities that can withstand salt and desiccation. But as you go up, you're getting into more normal sort of meadow plants, the sort you get in your back garden, like dandelions and clovers and things.
And even on the other side of the road, there are some trees.
Yeah, it's right the other side. You've got bushes, there's a shrub community, and then even some small trees, willows and things. It never quite reaches what we call a climax community. It never reaches a proper deciduous woodland because it's too harsh here. It's a lovely day today, but on a stormy day you'll get salt spray going right over onto the lake, and the plants have to be able to survive.
So as well as all of the green plants around here, we've also got this yellow sort of moss looking stuff on the rocks. What's that?
Yeah, well, those are pioneers as well. Those are lichens on the bare rock. And lichens are really interesting because they're a combination of an alga and a fungus. It's a symbiotic relationship between an alga and a fungus. And the alga photosynthesizes and produces oxygen and sugar. And the fungus uses the oxygen and produces carbon dioxide, which the alga uses. So they kind of live in harmony together. But they can live on bare rocks, and you get them anywhere. You get them on paving stones and roofs and things.
Yeah, because usually the ones that I've seen are green, but these are very bright.
Well, it's
here,
not a moss.
They?
It is a lichen, and lichens can be any colour. I mean, grey or green or yellow, red, some of them, you know, black, all sorts.
There are also some lovely flowers here. Here they are.
The white ones.
The white flowers. What are these?
That's sea campion.
Okay.
Now we're here in April and there's not a lot in flower at the moment. We've got sea campion is in flower, this little white flowers here. That's over there, there's a thing called Danish scurvy grass, which has got these small little white flowers as well. But most of the, and there's a few dandelions, most of the flowering, the real peak is in May through to the summer. And things are only just starting to take off now. A lot of these plants are members of the cabbage family. In fact, you know, humans have taken cabbage plants from coastal plants like this. So you get sea radish and sea beet and things like this, which have been cultivated and turned into food plants. In fact, you have to actually put salt on some domesticated cabbage plants to, because they grow best in salty soil.
But over there, we saw the sea kale, I think
that's
you said
kale, yeah,
what
yeah.
it was. But it's covered in snails. Now, I don't think they really like salt, do they?
No, they must be. I don't know. That plant is absolutely covered in snails. There must be 50 snails on that.
Yeah.
How they get there, I've no idea. Because they've got to get across 5 yards of shingle to get to that plant. But they've done it, they seem to be eating it. So.
Shows how adventurous these animals can be sometimes. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Those bushes there, they've got loads of this. This is sea plantain, and you can see there's about four different plantain species along here.
Yeah.
You can see this is the sea one because it's got the fleshy leaves.
Oh yeah.
Right? It's very thick leaves. I'm just pulling one open part now. It's got thick waxy leaves and they're quite narrow, and that's to stop water loss. Now, if you go up onto the top, there's ordinary plantain. There's the broadleaf plantain, which you'll get in your garden, and a ribwort plantain, the narrowleaf plantain. And those are not so well adapted as these.
When these things are growing on here, does that actually sort of help stop sort of the natural erosion of the shingle in any way?
Oh, I mean, that holds the shingle together and forms the soil, yeah. Yeah, so it does hold it all together. You can stabilise, in some parts of the coast, they've actually stabilised sandbanks by deliberate planting of particular species, and it holds them together. Marram grass, for example, is planted on some coastal dunes to hold it together, and it grows there naturally.
Yeah.
But, you know, you kind of conserve it and it will hold the...
Is that because of the root networks?
Yeah.
Holds everything in?
Roots are often deep. And
right.
We've got grasses growing here. There's couch or couch grass. That's that one that I'm looking at there. It's got sort of spiky bits. It's all looking a bit dead here at the moment. But the grass is here. These things coming out of this shingle. That's another pioneer growing between the sea spurge, which is the fleshy-leaved spurge plant. Those are the flowers there, the yellow flowers of the spurge. And... this has got a very extensive root network. If you pull this up, the roots go down, you know, and spread out through the shingle.
Right.
And hold it all together. Because there's no soil here, it's just shingle.
Yeah, and how deep is it, the shingle?
Well,
as deep as the sea.
Deep as the, yeah.
That's a dumb question.
I mean, metres, metres of it.
Yeah.
Actually, if you in some places, it does get swept away completely and you get sand and rocks and things underneath.
Hmm.
So it's several metres deep.
Yeah.
But up there, there's the soil. If you go further up the ridge, you've got soil and it's starting to get better conditions.
Right.
So why do they grow down here at all?
They've not got any competition from other plants. So they can grow without competition. So when it does rain, they gather up the rain quickly, absorb all the rain they can, and then wait till the next rain storm, and the soil never stays wet. There is no soil, it doesn't stay wet, so they don't they have to make do what they can get. They don't have to outcompete other plants to grow, whereas if you go into the meadow community at the top, you've got dozens of different species all battling for nutrients and water and everything, and then you end up with that one dominant thing like gorse.
We're going to walk along the rest of the ridge into the village of Tor Cross, and apparently there's something interesting in the car park. Phil has just stopped halfway on our way to Tor Cross.
I was looking at these plants. Well, it won't be very exciting. It won't be very exciting for most people. It's just a whole patch of buckthorn plantain. Buckthorn plantain is, I mean, there are four plantains here. There's the broadleaf plantain, there's the lance-leaved plantain, the narrow-leaved plantain, and there's the sea plantain, and this one, the buckthorn. And that's called buckthorn because it's got, the leaves are like little antlers. Right, antler shapes.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very small antlers.
Very small antlers. Now, this plant can actually get 2 feet tall.
Really?
Yeah. If it's growing in a hedgerow, it can get up to half a metre tall.
Yeah.
But here, it's been trampled by people walking on it. And it actually survives trampling really well, but only as a very small plant.
Okay.
Plantains are good at being trampled on. There's hardly anything here apart from the plantains, look. We've got, I mean, that. What's that? That's sea pink.
Mm-hmm.
And that does the same, that forms these clumps. So that's sea pink, and we've got a few other species. But they're all really the ones that can survive being heavily walked on.
Right.
Also along this stretch we have these sort of quite large lumps of rock. I'm presuming they're not natural, are they?
No, those are there to protect against the sea, to try and keep the beach from being damaged by the sea. And they're mostly granites and things that are not local. Look at this one. This is this one's growing a bit better. You remember that sea pink I was talking about? Well, this one's a bit more sheltered, and it's actually grown some flowers. And you can see the leaves are much longer here. So that's the same species as this much shorter clump of leaves, but it's because it's a bit more protected, it can grow better.
It's slightly further off the path, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not being walked on, and it's probably a bit sheltered from winds or something. It's got some rocks around it and so on. But you've actually got, you can see there, that's the buckthorn plantain, and even that's getting bigger leaves.
Right.
You know.
Just slightly away from the path.
Yeah, but it's amazing to think that thing can get to half a metre in height if it's really protected.
Right.
We've got a real collection here. In about a square metre of this turf, you've got plantains, you've got broadleaf plantain, buckthorn plantain, you've got yarrow, this little furry. This is yarrow. They're very small leaves here because they've been walked on. You've got sea carrot. That's sea carrot. Dorcas carota. That in the middle is
fennel.
Fennel.
Mm. Right. Oh yes, and that's used fennel. In the cookery with a lot with fish and things.
With fish, yeah. That is hogweed, I think. That's hogweed there, and that's last year's dead hogweed.
So, and that's this year's. Big,
yeah, hobbies? Yeah, they get up to a couple of metres. But you've also got that, that's sea beet. So you can see we're in a bit of a more meadow-like part of the ridge here.
Yeah.
It's actually quite thick grass, actually, isn't it?
It's thick grass, yeah.
Yes, I mean, considering we're only a couple of metres away from that very gravelly surface, we're into sort of the grass quite quickly.
Yeah, it's upset by the road. The road produces a kind of false break in the in the distribution here. Also the storm really disrupted things quite a bit. It mixed the communities up. When the sand was dumped across the road, it moved, a lot of the pioneers were shifted the other side of the road, so things got kind of jumbled quite a bit.
And that's presumably something that will keep on happening on a regular basis.
The 2001 storm was the worst they'd known. I mean, you get storms like that only every 50, 100 years or so. That bad. We've crossed over the road now to get away from the traffic noise. We can see the Tor Cross is about 200 metres, 200 yards down the road,
We spotted the exciting thing in the car park, which from this angle looks like a bottle bank with a turret, but
we can see lots of birds on the lake from here. Mainly ducks. I saw coot just now and a moorhen, but there are more exotic things turn up here. We saw cormorant, I think, earlier on, didn't we?
Yes.
We think.
Yes, definitely saw something large flying in. You know, from this angle, you get a much nicer view of the Lee here. Have we gone along far enough for this to be the lower Lee?
Oh, this is all the lower Lee. From the bridge downwards is all lower Lee. From the bridge upwards is the upper Lee, and that's not open water. So It's actually, the lake itself is quite shallow. The average depth is only a metre and a half.
All right.
And so it's actually a lot shallower than that. It's mostly mud and so on.
On a gorgeous day like this, I mean, the way that the sun is catching those hills on the other side there is just quite spectacular, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Well, the woodland over there is called France Wood. Preservation of the woodlands happened because of the wartime activities, because after they'd done all the shelling and bombing and so on, they couldn't use the wood for timber because the wood had fragments of metal in it, shrapnel in it, and so it would break the saws of the things. They couldn't cut any of them down, and that kind of helped preserve the woodland as it was. So we're going to walk on to Tor Cross
and have a look at this tank.
So we've decided to take a little bit of a rest. We're sitting in front of, I think it's a Sherman tank. Phil, why is this here?
It was part of the invasion exercise, and it was actually a swimming tank.
Right.
It had a big flotation skirt around it and some propellers, and it was launched out at sea and propelled in by these propellers, but it unfortunately sank. Luckily, the people on board were saved, and for years it remained out in the bay, about 300 metres out in the bay, until a local chap decided he would remove it from the bay, drag it in, and erect it here as a memorial to the American soldiers who died in the exercises.
So could you actually see it out in the sea before?
No, they knew it was there. Fishermen had caught nets on it and this kind of thing. Yeah. They knew it was there.
It must have been an awful lot of work to get something so big out of the sea.
He's Ken Small was the man who did it all, a local hotel owner. He spent a lot of time and money getting the tank out of the sea and communicating with the American government about ownership of the tank. He had to pay them.
Yeah. A token amount that just proved it was his to be able to move, full stop.
In his book, he wrote a book called The Forgotten Dead. He's got letters between him and President Reagan saying how thankful President Reagan was that he'd done this thing and so on. Yeah.
No, I mean, considering it was underwater for so long, it's in remarkable good condition, obviously.
I suppose it's mainly because it's such thick metal. I mean, the steel at the front is, I think it's about 75 millimetres thick, and even the sides and back must be 30 millimetres or so. So it would take a long time to rust.
I mean, the Sherman tank, this was one of the more numerous kinds of tanks in the Second World War, wasn't it?
By the time of D-Day, half the tanks that we used in Normandy were Shermans. They were not really very good, to be honest. They were very reliable, very good engines, very reliable, mechanically sound, but they had an unfortunate propensity to burst into flame if they were hit by a shell from a German tank. And they were known colloquially as Tommy Cookers by the Germans, or Ronsons by the British, because they burst into flame like the lighter.
I mean, even without that, looking at the size of, the area that the soldiers must have been in, it would be pretty horrific being in a battle situation in there.
Yeah, it's a little thing, isn't it? It's not even it's what they call a medium tank. It's quite a small tank compared with a lot of them. And it would have been very noisy, very uncomfortable inside. We've crossed over the road from the tank now, and we're just walking along the front of Tor Cross behind the sea wall. And the first house is quite interesting. It's called the Rocket House Cafe now. And they used to store rockets in there for rocketry, for sending distress signals and so on.
So we've just come up some funny little steps.
Yeah, they're called chapel steps.
Right.
Presumably there was a chapel up here somewhere, but there's no evidence of it now. We've walked behind the sea wall. The sea wall is quite a sort of concave, 4 or 5 metres high, 4 metres high, something like that. And it's protecting Tor Cross village from the sea. And it needs it because, there was a big storm in 1979, was the last really big storm, which damaged lots of the houses.
Right.
And after that, they built the sea wall.
And it's quite substantial, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So it survived the 2001 storm that damaged the road?
That didn't seem to affect it, and presumably it worked. And they've built up the front of it with blocks of stone there to take some of the energy out of the sea before it hits the village. Yeah. But we're walking up this place called Chapel Steps, and the hotel that we've just passed, I notice, is being converted into luxury apartments, which seems to be happening all the way down this coast.
presumably Torcross is traditionally a sort of fishing village, is it?
It was once, yeah, a fishing village. It's I don't think there's no fishing goes on here now, although they do. You see trawlers out in the bay.
We certainly saw one earlier on, I think.
Yeah, it's trawling for flatfish and so on out in the bay. But they, although Beesands, the next village along, is still a functioning, still has fishing boats.
And no, the seafood restaurants are sort of still popular down here.
Yes, there's still that. I mean, it's mostly just a tourist holiday place now. There's not even very much of that here. It's very quiet compared with a lot of the coast.
And where do these steps lead to? At the moment, I can see the hillside, and that's it.
They go up the top of the hill, and we will then walk over the top of the hill down into the village of Beesands. It's following the coast path.
Right.
You know, so we're off the road now for quite a bit. What's this thing on the left? It's like a gun emplacement, is it? Or a wartime observation post?
It certainly looks like that, doesn't it?
A pillbox, anyway.
A pillbox built into the side of the hill.
Should we walk up to the top of the steps and then we can get a good look back over the lake and tour across them?
Okay.
Well, that noise you can hear in the background is developers knocking down the hotel and building luxury apartments. But I just wonder what you thought of the view at the top of Chapel Steps.
I think it's a lovely view. You can see the lake on one side and then you can see the sea on the other and the ridge splitting the two. So actually talking about all the things earlier about the ridge, and you can see now how it all works, which is really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a beautiful day, so it's bright blue sky and bright blue sea. And bright blue lake, it's lovely.
The shingle are lovely yellow as well.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
It's a very picture postcard, really, isn't it?
It is.
You've got a couple of miles of shingle stretching into the distance in a big arc, and the sea on one side and lake on the other. But it's just beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah. You can see all the rolling hills at the back as well. Yeah.
We've come to the top of Chapel Steps. Now, what we're going to do now is follow the coast path a little. We're heading for an area. There's an area around the top of the hill called Thorn Hills, and then we'll be going over the hill down into the next village, which is Beesands. So we'll stop at the top of the next open field and have a look at what's ahead. We've stopped at the top after the area called Thorn Hills, and it's a field leading up a hill with a wood at the top of the hill. In the distance, looking south, we can see the lighthouse of Start Point.
Very clearly today, certainly.
Yeah, very clear. Nice, lovely view. And along the coast, can't see Beesands yet, that's hidden by the hill, but after that you can see the village of Hallsands in the distance.
Nestling just sort of at the bottom of the... clinging onto the cliffs from this angle, well,
right. And you can see the two radio masts there behind the village. The walk to Beesands is quite quick. We walk over the hill and we're actually skirting round a circular quarry.
Right.
The bedrock here is a slate. And it's a sort of grey, bluey coloured slate.
We saw a little bit of it just as we were coming up the steps there, didn't we?
Yes, it's used for building materials and roofs and things, but it's not very good. It's nowhere near like Welsh slate. But interestingly, the geology suddenly changes along here, and we'll see this. On the other side of here, we will come across different type of rock underneath, which is what Start Point's made of.
So carrying on up the hill then until we get to the next stop.
This is Beesands Village, and we've just walked along the front past a large village green. And a football pitch.
A slightly wonky football pitch.
Yes.
Beesands has still got a local football team, which I find difficult to believe when there's so few houses here, but there is a football team.
It's certainly quite impressive.
Yeah, the football pitch has got a sort of very uneven surface, and you know, one end's higher than the other, which gives you a big advantage for half the game. The green along there that we've just walked by used to be a caravan site, but that's now gone. And there's just the houses now, and it's a little fishing village. There's a very nice pub here called the Cricket Inn, where we've stopped and had a cup of coffee.
So where do we go from here then?
We just walk along the coast path now, up the hill and over the top of the hill. It's signposted, the coast path.
We've walked up the hill from Beesands onto Tinsley Head, which I believe is owned by the National Trust. And we're standing right at the top, and we've got views all the way back from where we came and all the way over to Start Point. And it's just beautiful. It's very idyllic. We can see some sailing boats, a few fishing boats, a few birds. It's very nice.
And a very pleasant breeze blowing up here as well.
Yes.
Tinsley Head's a perfect place to see forward and back, because you can see Hoare Sands along the coast, and you can see Bee Sands just, and the sweep of Slapton Sands in the distance.
It's quite reassuring in many ways as well that the end looks closer than the beginning of the walk from here.
So that's over halfway now.
So. Well and truly over halfway, so that's good to hear.
What I am looking out for along here is that somewhere along here the geology changes. And we go from the sedimentary rocks, slates back there, that you get in Slapton, to a whole different metamorphic rocks called schists. And you'll see the difference when we see some rocks, but we might miss where it actually changes because we'll need an exposure to see it. But the whole of Start Point down the end is a different kind of rock than what we've been travelling on so far.
What is it we're looking for?
Well, they're kind of shiny crystalline rocks. You'll see the difference. Whereas the slates are soft grey.
Yeah, flat, very flat.
Yeah, they're sort of dark grey. They're kind of metamorphic quartz, feldspar, mica schists. And they've got a lot of crystals and things in them, and you'll see them. See, the only two exposures of it are here, in the whole of the southwest, are here, and at the Lizard, I believe, in Cornwall. The Lizard Point is made of the same rock. Yeah, there's more of it out in the channel.
Okay.
We've just got a bit of it coming to the surface here, and in Cornwall.
Okay, then on we go. Keeping
just
our eyes open.
All the admiring all the primroses here, but it's quite early, and there's a lot of primroses, bluebells, little violets, and really quite attractive. But they're probably only here for a month or so, and then they'll be gone. We've stopped briefly a couple of hundred metres on from the last stop to have a look at Hoare Sands from the distance so that we can get some idea of the layout. Now, Hoare Sands itself is actually two villages, North Hoare Sands and Hoare Sands Village. And North Hoare Sands is the first houses you get to. It's made up of some 60s, 50s council houses on the right there and some newer houses. And then on the hill itself, you've got some brand new modern housing, some expensive housing that's just been put up in 2007, 2008. You can see those four houses there. Then in the distance, right the way around the corner of the sort of headland of Hoare Sands, you've got the remains of the old Hoare Sands village. And that was a fishing village that was destroyed by storms in the early part of the 20th century. There's a big story to this, which we'll come to later on. But you get a good view of it from here. You can see the ruined cottages of the village that were, you know, that was once a thriving fishing village with about 50 or 60 houses in it. Now all gone, except for one or two of them.
Yeah, it looks like a sort of a ghost in the distance, because you can just see part of one house.
It's in the shadows there, isn't it?
Yeah.
The other thing we can see on top of the hill, there are the two transmitter towers. What are they for?
They were built in 1939. They're radio transmission towers. It's the West Regional Transmitting Station, and it was to improve radio reception across the southwest. The whole of the southwest was transmitted from here. So we're just going to walk down into North Hoare Sands Village now, down the hill. Okay, I'm coming.
Here we go.
I can open this gate.
Stay here. Well, we've got to the bottom of the hill now, and we've reached the little village of Hoare Sands we were talking about a moment ago. I mean, the first obvious thing from here is the amount of building that's going on.
Yes, there's a lot of new houses being built on the front here. There's some blocks of new houses, probably summer vacation houses for people. Those older houses at the top of the hill look like they're going to be demolished or rebuilt to me as well to form units. I think, don't you think? Those ones up there that have got the scaffolding.
They're certainly not looking.
Yeah, they do look like they're about to go.
Yeah. The other thing standing here we notice is we have another mini split between the sea and some wet.
Yeah, they get smaller. Whereas Bee Sands had a small lake, Slapton's got a huge lake. Here you've just got a little kind of salt marsh.
Was it reeds growing in there?
A reed bed, yeah. It's just a little wet area where some of the streams accumulate behind the shingle ridge here before the water drains through the shingle. But we've not really got a lake here, just a wetland area.
So we've stopped at a building here now at the top of the hill above Horsesands. It has a foundation stone that said it was laid by Patience and Ella Trout in 1925. What do we know about them?
Absolutely fascinating history, the Trout sisters. This building used to be called Trout's Hotel, and it originates when the village of Horsesands was destroyed, which we're coming on to in a moment when we stop to look at the remains of the village. Now, some of the people that were made homeless from the village were the Trout family, Mrs. Eliza Trout, who was the widow of a fisherman, and she had four daughters called Patience, Ella, Clara and Edith. And the Trouts used some of the money. They eventually got compensation for the destruction of their homes, and they used some of the money to build this hotel, which they called Prospect House.
Prospect House being what it's still called today?
It's still called that today. It's just been recently rebuilt as modern apartments and holiday homes. Up until very recently, it was a tea rooms and holiday homes, but it's just been renovated. And Patience and Ella were the kind of the main characters in this, because they did all of the work. They did a lot of the digging the foundations. They were really hard-working fishermen types anyway, they were fisherwomen, shifting sand up from the beach and mixing the concrete and so on. And they weren't afraid of hard work. So when they finished the hotel, the guest house, it grew to be incredibly successful. And by the 1930s, it was catering for up to about 70 guests. Its reputation grew and grew, and they took on staff, they took on a cook and a housekeeper, and they were entrepreneurs. They really introduced lots of modern ideas. They were first down here to introduce central heating to the house. They had their own electrical supply, a generator. They built their own water supply from the valley, the stream in the valley. They went on continental tours of Europe in a car. They learnt to drive and so on.
It certainly sounds like they were ahead of their time in many ways.
Lots of ways they were ahead of their time. Do you notice on the sign that Ella Trout has got an OBE after her name?
Yes, but not the other one, presumably.
No, just Ella. Ella got the OBE for rescuing a drowning sailor in the First World War. And she was out fishing with her 10-year-old cousin, and they saw a ship that had been torpedoed. And they rescued a drowning sailor, and the parents of the sailor were very, thankful to them. And she got an OBE for it. Trout's Hotel went on into the 1940s, and it was very successful. They used to cook fresh fish, and they'd go fishing still, and they would cook the fish, and the guests were entertained to nice meals, and they'd go swimming on the beach and this kind of thing. Until what happened in 1949, Patience Trout suddenly died, and she went up to her room feeling a bit unwell. Ella went up an hour later to see what was going on, and she'd died. Ella then died 3 years later. She went to her sister's grave to lay some flowers on her grave and collapsed and died over the sister's grave, and they're buried in Stokenham churchyard. And the younger sister had already left, so that left Edith, the remaining sister, and the cook, housekeeper, to look after the place. And she left in 1958, Gertrude, the cook, left. And it was just Edith who was left in there. And Edith became a sort of recluse. She would hide herself away in there, and she kept everything like it had been in 1950. And she went on living there until 1975. And when they opened up the house, she'd not thrown anything away. It was full of hundreds of empty matchboxes. And she lived like a hermit-like existence in there. And it's said that the tables in the hotel were always set for dinner. Anyway, after Edith's death, the hotel was made into flats, holiday flats, and a tea room. And it stayed that way for 30 years. It's been sold recently to developers and converted into holiday apartments. Amazing story.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're going to walk on down and have a look at the viewing platform to look at the old ruined village of Horsesands, which is about 100 yards down the hill. And then you can stand and look over the old village.
So we've come down the hill a little bit now onto this wooden platform to be able to see over what's left of the original Horsesands village.
Yeah, this is the Horsesands village itself, not as opposed to North Horsesands. And This used to be a fishing village up until the early part of the 20th century. And now there's only two houses left that are habitable, and they're country cottages. This one just on the end here, and there's one just around the corner that we can't see.
I'm quite amused that one's called Sea View.
Sea
I think
View.
That's an it's understatement.
Not, yeah. The sea's viewed right into it. What happened with it is that in the 1890s, the Admiralty dredged sand and gravel from the bay. There are gravel banks out to sea here.
And this was to aid access to Plymouth or something?
No, it was for building the docks at Plymouth. It was for making concrete at Plymouth. And they took thousands of tons of gravel out of the bay. And immediately the villagers started noticing that their beach level was falling. And the theory now is that the gravel out in the bay was protecting the beach against erosion, against tidal wave action and erosion. Mm. There's a lot of controversy about whether or how much it was involved, but certainly the beach level started falling. They went on doing it, the villagers went on complaining and MPs got involved. And then the fatal night came in 1917 when, after the beach level had collapsed so much that some of the houses had actually started falling down, and the rest of the village was really devastated by a storm. Houses were collapsed, the roadway through the village was collapsed, the pub, there used to be two pubs in the village at one time. You can see now, if you look at it, you can see the level of where the houses were. There's a kind of level platform where the houses were.
The bit sort of sticking out there behind these houses.
Yeah, and this is where, like this one in the first house is. Now, the beach level used to come right up to there so that people could launch their boats from, you know, the level
straight onto
the beach sort of thing. The beach level just fell and fell, and apparently the level fell by 13 feet.
And that,
the seawall,
20 years, was it roughly?
It was over a period of about 20 years, And the seawall became undermined and that started collapsing. Mm. Eventually they built some new cottages. There was a long wrangle about whose fault it was, and it was clearly the fault of the people who dredged the gravel, or at least partly their fault. And they eventually got some compensation, which the Trout sisters used to build the hotel.
Yep.
But the other villagers were rehoused, and some of the houses in the village were replacements for the families that lived here.
I guess at the time so little was known about, you know, the movement of the sea and exactly how everything works together.
Well, it's still unclear today whether the dredging was totally responsible or whether it was just conditions at Hall Sands were made the beach unstable anyway. I mean, it's not a very good position here. You know,
it certainly looks precarious, doesn't it?
I mean, the coast is eroding all over the place.
Yeah.
All the way around the coast, you're getting erosion and you're getting addition to the coast in other places. And here you're getting erosion. And whether it would have happened without the dredging is anybody's guess, really.
Is this perhaps the kind of thing that we've been mentioning at various points on the walk, that we're never actually going to stop nature regardless of what happens?
I think that's right. You know, we're battling against it. Sea walls and things do work, but in the long run, you can't really battle against nature, and it's a losing battle eventually.
Yeah. And also, things like erosion happen regardless of climate change. The fact that the sea level rising perhaps makes it worse. But
emphasises it.
Exactly,
yeah.
But you know, it does happen, whatever.
So what we're going to do now is walk back up to the coast path, and we've got our last bit of the journey along to Stark Point. We're just taking a break on the cliffs just to look back at the view, really.
We've just walked through. It looks like a tunnel of trees. Why is that there?
Yes, it's a peculiar formation. It's a phenomenon called wind pruning, and we've seen it quite a lot along the coast here. And what happens is that the wind from the sea coming inland kills the buds on the side that the wind is coming from.
Right.
The seaside.
Generally.
Yeah. So the buds tend to grow on the other side inland.
Yeah.
And so the whole bush ends up growing over away from the wind.
Right.
So it grows in that direction. It's called wind pruning.
Forming these sort of natural tunnels that
you see
quite often sort of along coast.
Yeah, well, the tunnels there are formed just sort of because it bends over onto the land and you get a sort of protected area. But if you also notice, what's interesting along here is the geology has changed and we've got new rocks. We were walking on slates along there, these sedimentary blue-grey slates, and now we're on this metamorphic rock. It's much harder crystalline rock that you can see here. And the whole of this Stark Peninsula is made of this rock.
So just a little bit further up here then, and then we're back to the car park, where today we have left a cart in order to get us back to street to pick up the other car. Hopefully you have arranged something similar.
Well, we've arrived at the car park at Start Point, and if you're going to do this walk, this is the best option, really, is to take two cars and leave one at each end so that you can get back afterwards, unless you want a 12-mile walk instead of a 6-mile walk. You can get a taxi, but it's quite difficult down here to get one.
Right.
And there's certainly no public transport from Start Point.
But you'll be able to find details on the website.
Yeah. I mean, the good thing about Start Point car park is the view, because you get such a superb view of where you've come from and where you're heading to. And if you look back along the coast, you can see, in order, you can see the old Horsands village, the ruined village, North Horsands, and then Bee Sands with its little shingle ridge, finally Slapton Shingle Ridge, and Torcross, just about visible.
Yeah, Torcross hiding behind the headland there.
So you get a really good view, and then the view, a half-mile walk down the access road to the lighthouse, which is where we're going now. Actually, interestingly, can you see that the headland, the rocks are much taller and not so weathered away, and that's because they're harder material. The metamorphic rocks are less easily weathered, so we've got higher rocks of different topography here.
Yeah, it looks really craggy, doesn't it?
Yes, it's craggy, yeah, right, sort of outcrops of rocks.
Yeah, and actually, if you look back, it's very different, looking at perhaps where the rocks might have changed, because it's much taller, isn't it, after the Horsands?
I think so, yes. I think we can probably tell from where it goes from being gentle slopes to being more steeper and less rounded. The rock types have changed, but it's difficult to say because they're covered by soil there.
I mean, certainly the other side of Horsands there is, it's much softer. Landscape, isn't it?
Yeah, it's much more rolling hills.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Whereas now we're on a sort of very rugged outcrop which has Devon coastline written all over it to me.
Yeah. Right, shall we walk on down to the lighthouse and finish our journey?
Absolutely.
Okay. This is Start Point Lighthouse, which is the end of the walk. Built in 1836. It's got a battlement parapet around it. It looks a bit like a castle. And that reflects the Gothic architecture of the time, early Victorian. Originally it had two white lights, one fixed one and one revolving one, and also a bell to warn during fogs and so on. Now there's a very loud foghorn that goes off when it's foggy here. And in 1870, it was renovated, the whole tower, and the lighthouse keepers' cottages were built. I'm not sure what they lived in up till then. And it's now fully automatic, of course, so there's no lighthouse keepers at all. And it's only open to the public at certain times, and it's closed today.
Of course. Yeah. It's interesting to see that it looks like you can rent the cottage as well, so it might be quite nice for a holiday down here.
Yes, yeah. It's the end of our walk here, and we're going to walk back up to the Start Point car park and take the car back to our starting place, Street Gate.